crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Shalom lekulam and welcome to another Watch Jerusalem broadcast. I'm Chris Eames and I'll be your host again for today. I'll be taking over from your regular host, Brent Nagtigal. Brent is currently out touring somewhere in Israel with my sister and her husband. It's my sister's first time in Israel, so she and my brother-in-law are out sightseeing, not sure where they are at the moment. I know they've been to the Dead Sea and to Masada already. Masada, as many of you know, is an extraordinarily high, isolated rock plateau, atop of which King Herod built one of his palaces, and the views there are amazing, but it's certainly a tiresome hike. I've been there a couple of times. I think it's at least 45 minutes of constant walk up a staircase, sidling the cliff face to the palace at the summit. Building that kind of a palace would have been a maddening thing to do, going up and down the cliff face of that rock plateau, lugging equipment and goods. That would have been just a terrible job. And for all that, Herod rarely ever went there. They say there's a fine line between genius and insanity. While I think Herod had some moments of genius, such as building the Second Temple, I think it's pretty safe to say that he has had more often than not the insanity side of things. So, of course, Masada is well known also for being the place of the last Jewish stand after the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. The Romans built a massive siege ramp up the side of one of Masada's cliff faces. Now, when the Romans finally broke through the defences, they eerily found that the Jewish defenders, in desperation, had committed a mass suicide. That's what Josephus tells us in his writings of the history there at Masada. So a really interesting, tragic place. And excavations restarted there a couple of months ago. These were the first excavations on Masada in over a decade. So it'll be interesting to see whatever is turned up from those excavations. Anyway, on Watch Jerusalem today, I've got a few subjects I'd like to cover today. Of course, last week, Israel celebrated her own July 4th equivalent, her Independence Day, so we'll cover that. Also, we'll cover another UNESCO resolution that got passed this week. That's another humdinger, as you'll see. And we'll cover a recent, somewhat unusual archaeological discovery that happened recently in the area of ancient Phoenicia. And we also might look at a few other recent events that occurred last week in brief, if we have time. Okay, so to begin things off, a week ago Israel celebrated Yom Ha'atzmaut, Independence Day. Of course, as usual, this day follows straight after Yom HaZikaron, or Israel's Remembrance Day. For Independence Day, there were all the usual celebrations, air shows, fireworks, the International Bible Competition. We'll talk a little more about that competition at the end of this program. There was also the awarding of the Israel Prize, Israel's most prestigious award and honor that gets given to Israel's most significant cultural and scientific and generally awesome contributors to Israeli society. I think there's usually about 10 to 15 people that receive that award. So 69 years as an independent nation since it was established in 1948. And, of course, this year is also the big 50-year anniversary for Jerusalem as Israel's capital after, of course, the 1967 war. Now, the population figures to this latest Independence Day show that the population is currently at 8.68 million in Israel. That's a tenfold increase since the nation was established. So, of course, a very happy day for many Israelis and one through which the miracles that went into establishing the nation, through especially the early wars and struggles, can really be appreciated. But, of course, there are the multitude of problems that must unfortunately be faced as well, and one in particular last week that conveniently managed to slot its way into the same time frame as Independence Day celebrations. This is, of course, the UNESCO resolution, UNESCO, UNESCO resolution that was passed last Tuesday aimed at Israel, or should I say occupied Palestine, that would be closer to the text. This resolution was submitted by Algeria, Lebanon, Morocco, Egypt, Oman, Qatar, and Sudan. So I think you know where this one is going. Yes, we have this latest resolution delivered by the bastions of freedom, fairness, liberty, and diplomacy. The UN's cultural arm has been wielded strongly again by those chief proponents of culture and science. Of course, I speak with sarcasm. The resolution was passed, however, with fewer votes than normal, which was good to see. We'll look at who was for and against it further down. But anyway, let's have a little perusal of what was written. So the text begins with, "To the Executive Board, having examined document 201EX30, recalling the provisions of 4 Geneva Conventions, we get into the meat of the subject here. Reaffirming the importance of the Old City of Jerusalem and its walls for the 3 monotheistic religions." So starting off with reaffirming this importance here for the 3 religions. So that's all well and good, but the only thing that this report reinforces, as usual, is really the importance of Jerusalem for one religion, and that is, of course, Islam. There seems to be a general theme with these reports in terms of beginning with reaffirming the importance of the city for the 3 religions, quickly blow through that, and then begin to launch into why this is important just for Islam. We follow on with the text, reminding that all legislative and administrative measures and actions taken by Israel, the occupying power, which have altered or purport to alter the character and status of the holy city of Jerusalem, and in particular the basic law on Jerusalem, are null and void and must be rescinded forthwith. So we've got a claim here that there is something going on here, altering or purporting to alter the character and status of the holy city of Jerusalem. Quite frankly, I'd like to know what alterations Israel has been doing to the, quote, holy city of Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock is still there as ever. Al-Aqsa is still there as ever. The Temple Mount is still run under the Islamic Waqf administration as ever. Jews there are still under restrictions, various restrictions from entering the site as ever. So it isn't substantiated here what the alterations are, but it's just inserted into the text. There are some alterations going on to the holy city of Jerusalem. The text continues, regrets the failure of Israeli occupying authorities to cease the persistent excavations, tunneling, works and projects in East Jerusalem, particularly in and around the Old City of Jerusalem, which are illegal under international law, and reiterates its request to Israel, the occupying power, to prohibit all violations which are not in conformity with the provisions of the relevant UNESCO conventions, resolutions and decisions. So there we have a complaint about excavations, tunneling, works and projects in East Jerusalem. I'd like to point out what I regret, really. It's the Islamic excavations, tunnelings, works and projects on the Temple Mount itself. These illegal excavations have been documented for a long time. The mass bulldozing of ancient sites there on the Temple Mount in order to create Islamic mosques. But obviously that goes overlooked in this text, in this biased text. The text continues it deplores the military confrontations in and around the Gaza Strip and the civilian casualties caused, as well as attacks on schools and other educational and cultural facilities. So, mentioning here, attacks on schools and other educational and cultural facilities, without qualifying them or anything. So basically, according to this, Israel just likes to take out a school once in a while just for the fun of it. I mean, this bias here is in this text is about thick enough to swim in. Continuing with the text, we read that this UNESCO resolution also deplores the continuous Israeli closure of the Gaza Strip, which harmfully affects the free and sustained movement of personnel, students, and humanitarian relief items, and requests Israel to immediately end this closure. Now, of course, there's no mention about how Egypt handles their border opening with Gaza. Obviously, Israel, I think, has 5 or 6 border openings with Gaza, and then Egypt has one herself. So, obviously, no calls for freer movement on the Egyptian side. Here's one fact, though. Through just one of Israel's border crossings with Gaza, it's called the Keren Shalom crossing, there's about 1,000 trucks that deliver goods through that crossing per day. 1,000 trucks are allowed through that crossing. Anyway, continuing with the text, reaffirms that the two concerned sites located in Al-Khalil, Hebron, and in Bethlehem are an integral part of the occupied Palestinian territory and shares the conviction affirmed by the international community that the two sites are of religious significance for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Again, attempting to reaffirm the support before we can guess, arguing that the sites should only have anything to do with the religion of Islam. The text continues, it deplores the ongoing Israeli excavations, works, construction of private roads for settlers and of a wall inside the old city of Hebron, which are illegal under international law and harmfully affect the authenticity and integrity of the site, and the subsequent denial of freedom of movement and freedom of access to the places of worship. So we'll stop here again. Denial of freedom of movement and freedom of access to places of worship. Actually, this is an interesting point. The criticism of Israel against freedom to access of places of worship. There are actually over 400 mosques in Israel. This many, 400 for a nation somewhere in size between Maryland and West Virginia. For our American listeners, that doesn't mean much more to me being from New Zealand, but somewhere in size between Maryland and West Virginia, about 400 mosques in Israel. And let's talk about restriction on religion. Jews face various restrictions on the Temple Mount. While they're sometimes allowed to visit, they are forbidden from any religious activity within the walls, forbidden from any prayer within the walls. Of course, there's a number of mosques on the Temple Mount. Muslims are allowed to practice their religion freely on the site. But Jews are restricted from entering the Temple Mount. Jews are restricted from entering Bethlehem. Jews are forbidden from entering the city of Jericho. Now, these are deeply sacred and meaningful places to many Jews. And in the case of the Temple Mount being the most holy site to Judaism. So what we see here is not Muslim freedom of worship being restricted. What we see here is Jewish freedom of worship in her own country, heavily more restricted than Muslim freedom of worship. Muslims are allowed freedom of worship at their third most holy site, the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif, as they call it, their third most holy site. To the Jews, it is counted as their first most holy site, yet they are restricted from practicing religion there. So let's not get caught up in Muslim restriction of practicing religion. It's actually quite the opposite of what this report makes out. But of course, this doesn't fit the narrative that the proponents of this resolution would like to bring across. So finally, the report concludes with the following. Point 16 decides to include these matters under an item entitled Occupied Palestine in the agenda at its 202nd session. So we've got to look forward to that one. I'm sure that'll be a zinger. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stated that, quote, Israel does not believe in the UN. And by way of that, the UN's daughter organization there, UNESCO, and it's pretty plain to see why that's the case. Anyway, the bill won the votes of the likes of Russia, China, Iran, Sweden, etc., the usual. Opposing it, however, was the United States, which may have been a different story under the last administration. But we had the United States opposing it this time, alongside the United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, etc. So we've written a lot about Germany's relationship with Israel at the moment. You can check out Brent's Watch Jerusalem podcast from last week for more about German-Israeli relations. As we've also written about on the website, Bible prophecy has much to say on the German-Israeli relations in the near future and how on-the-surface good relations are actually a facade to something much more sinister on the horizon. Anyway, that's another topic, one that you can read on our website, watchjerusalem.co.il. All right, next in our lineup of recent news, US President Trump just met with the head of the Palestinian Authority and Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas. You may have seen the pictures of this meeting that happened last week, meeting in the White House, the formal lunch, etc. I'm sure as the days progress, we'll see more analysis and results from this meeting. Of course, the main focus of the meeting was the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. On this topic, Mr. Trump said at a press conference, "We will get it done. We will be working so hard to get it done. It's been a long time, but we will be working diligently, and I think there's a very, very good chance." Trump also stated about the peace deal, quote, "It's something that I think is, frankly, maybe not as difficult as people have thought over the years. We need two willing parties. We believe Israel is willing, and we believe you're willing." That pointed to Mahmoud Abbas, who was with him. And he continues, "And if you are willing, we are going to make a deal." End of quote. Now, even if Abbas is willing, and I certainly don't believe for a moment that he truly is willing, but even if he is willing, he certainly doesn't speak for his population. A recent poll found that barely over half the Palestinian population, 51%, actually wants a two-state solution. Now, this is usually brought across by the mainstream media as essentially nearly the entire group of Palestinians that are actually wanting this two-state solution. Actually, this poll shows barely half of the Palestinians want a two-state solution. Added to that, Abbas himself is quite unpopular among many Palestinians. There is, of course, already the massive, sometimes violent divide between the Palestinians in Gaza under Hamas and the Palestinians faithful to Fatah. There's a big divide there, and considering that Abbas is currently serving his 13th year of his 4-year term, so it's been 11 years since proper elections, democracy isn't really taking root very well in the West Bank. And with Abbas paying salaries to support the families of convicted terrorists, terrorists who are in jail or have been killed during the act, further terrorism is merely encouraged rather than disavowed. So whether or not one unpopular leader is willing to come to a peace agreement has no real lasting bearing on this situation. Did the assassination of Osama bin Laden stop al-Qaeda terrorism? Of course not. That's not how it works. Anyway, at the meeting with President Trump, Abbas continued to stress the need for two states based on pre-1967 borders. He also stated that, quote, "We are raising our youth, our children, our grandchildren on a culture of peace." Now, if you know anything about anything, you know that that isn't true, that that statement isn't true, that we are raising our youth, our children, our grandchildren on a culture of peace. I've seen for myself the Palestinian children's television shows, bright, colorful, with fancy dress, aimed at kids around the age of 5 years old. Children's television shows calling for violence and death to Jews. These same shows, one of them with, I think, someone, an adult dressed up in a Buzzy Bee uniform, and just very jovial kind of show aimed at really young kids, encouraging violence, hatred, death towards Jews. So I don't think that's raising youth on a culture of peace, to quote Abbas. And of course, the constant terror attacks as a result of this speak for themselves. So on the topic of terror attacks, you probably had seen the news of the attack a couple of weeks ago, the death of 21-year-old British student Hannah Bladon. She had been travelling on a train in Jerusalem that morning when she was stabbed to death by a Palestinian assailant. It turns out she had been living in Birmingham, England, and had been in Jerusalem as part of an exchange program with the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She had just participated in an archaeological dig somewhere in Jerusalem, I believe, that morning, and had boarded a train later in the day. She had given up her seat on the train for a pregnant woman who was standing, and thus placed herself right next to her killer rather than the pregnant woman. Well, I just wanted to bring this up because this attack hits quite close to home for me. I'm currently living on the outskirts of Birmingham in England. That's where I'm delivering this program for you today. And I've traveled back and forth to Israel for a number of archaeological excavations. I've worked at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem a number of times. So I would have crossed similar paths with the student, not much younger than myself. Now, I'm not sure where she would have been working on those archaeological excavations that morning, but these kind of events, though, are so tragic and just indiscriminate. They happen to Jews, they happen to foreigners like this Brit, like the 18-year-old American a year and a half ago who was killed while handing out food to IDF soldiers, Israeli Defense Forces soldiers. And should we expect any lasting condemnation of these attacks? Of course not, especially not from the Arab community. They've just issued their condemnations against Israel for things like, quote, the visual impact of a wall being built in Hebron, or for the supposed restrictions to freedom of religion in Israel. There seems to be hardly any kind of long-lasting condemnation against anything like this against Israel. In regards to the Israeli-Palestinian question, it seems the most long-lasting of condemnation seems to always end up against Israel. And so the tragedies just keep happening and the anti-Semitism just keeps growing, not just in the Arab world, but all around the globe. So we'll have to wait and see what Trump's idea is then for a peace agreement between the two sides. One thing's for sure, and if you've been a regular follower of Watch Jerusalem, you'll be well familiar with this. There will be no peaceful two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. In fact, we continue to forecast an end-time prophecy that can be found in Zechariah 14 that states that Jerusalem will be violently split in two, with half the city, East Jerusalem, captured and controlled by the Palestinians. This action will then lead to a chain of disastrous events culminating in the coming of the Messiah. You can read more details on this incredible prophecy at our website, watchjerusalem.co.il. Also, feel free to request our free booklet on the subject entitled Watch Jerusalem and Prophecy, written by Mr. Gerald Fleury. You can download the booklet online from our website or order a free hard copy for yourself. Alternatively, you can email us at letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. That's letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Or write to us for any literature requests or general comments or questions at the following address: Watch Jerusalem, P.O. Box 8314, Jerusalem 9108201, Israel. Okay, we'll take a short break and be right back with you.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm. Thank you for listening.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm.
Okay, segueing into other news now, archaeology. Last month, a report came out about a discovery that was made on the coasts of ancient Phoenicia, just to the north of Israel. Like I stated at the top of this program, this is a rather unusual discovery, evidence of a massive tsunami that slammed into the shore 2,800 years ago. Scientists discovered a thick accumulation of sand, stones, and pottery heaped above a Phoenician cemetery, which itself was several meters above sea level. Evidence for the tsunami has been found along the coastline from the cemetery at Achziv to Rosh Hanikra. The scientists believe that the tsunami itself must have been a wave of about up to 9 meters or 30 feet high. One problem, though, for such a large wave having smashed into the coast, there are no records of it that have thus far been discovered. Archaeologists believe that such a big event surely must have been recorded unless all those present to witness it were killed, which seems unlikely. One other thing, though, that I thought might be interesting about this massive tidal wave, it has been dated to have occurred during the 8th century BC. Now, what else happened during the 8th century BC? Could the Bible have had a record of this event? Well, it's open to some speculation, which I've done a little bit of regarding this. And the prophet Jonah was actually on the scene during that same period within the 8th century BC. So perhaps it was related to him. Jonah chapter 1 records a remarkably fierce storm aboard the ship that Jonah was traveling on. In order to escape his commission from God, he had the crew toss him overboard in order to quell the waters. So perhaps the storm had something to do with that, or perhaps more likely it had something to do with the large sea creature that swallowed up Jonah. Jonah 2 verse 10 says that the fish, quote, vomited out Jonah upon the dry land, end of quote. Now, this would have had to have been a massive fish to swallow Jonah, massive sea creature to swallow him. This creature naturally would not have swum close to the shore, so how must it have vomited out Jonah onto the dry land? Could it be that God sent a massive tidal wave in order to drive this giant creature right up to the shore, right up to the shore's edge, where it then vomited Jonah out onto the dry land? Could it be? Obviously, this is just speculation, but hey, it's fun. Who knows? It makes sense to me. So an interesting discovery there in the territory of ancient Phoenicia, a massive tsunami from the 8th century BC. Well, in other news, briefly, there has been last week the International Bible Quiz held in Jerusalem in conjunction with the Independence Day celebrations. The winner of this quiz was 15-year-old Sagiv Lugasi, and he is the first winner in 30 years to be from a non-religious school. Sagiv said that he spent 2 years preparing for the quiz and near to the competition. He didn't go to school for 2 months, studying for 12 hours a day, so certainly sounds intense and rigorous. Now, just to give you listeners an idea of the kind of questions, really tough questions that these young people face for this International Bible Quiz, I want to read out the final question that Sagiv Lugasi was asked. And see for yourselves if you can answer this question. He was asked the following, for the final question, he was asked, which biblical person said the following, quote, "And be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord," end of quote. I'll say that again. Who said the following, "And be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord." So, any answers? Sagiv got the answer immediately, without hesitation, as you can tell from the video of the event. The answer is the prophet Haggai. So I was amazed by that. I was amazed that this young 15-year-old knew the answer right away. So the text of this question was actually only a partial segment of Haggai 2 verse 4. It wasn't even the entire verse. So if any of you listeners out there got the answer right, well done. Those are certainly tough questions these young people are asked. So well done to 15-year-old Sagiv. Anyway, that about wraps things up for Watch Jerusalem today. I hope you've enjoyed listening and hope you have a good week. And be sure to tune in next time. Goodbye.